Good afternoon and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'm here today with Justice Alaska's co-host and legal expert, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Today, we are speaking with researchers from the UAA Justice Center, currently engaged in work for the Alaska Department of Public Safety. Their work was launched by the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, a legislative effort in Alaska and the U.S. Department of Justice nationally, to come to grips with the numbers of sexual assault kits that have been used in investigations but never submitted. Their research work is really not about the kits, but about sexual assault investigations and a better understanding of what justice looks like to the many stakeholders in an investigation, and very importantly, what justice looks like to victim survivors of sexual assault. Now, Elaine is going to introduce our guests in just a second, but first I want to talk a little bit about a conversation I had with Representative Garantar this morning. She saw the announcement of the show and called to say that she wanted to be clear that it was a legislative effort that got the inventory and the sort of coming to grips with the unsubmitted sexual assault kits, and that it was really a four-year effort and that was quite bipartisan. And she mentioned SB 55 and also HB 31. And there were a couple points she really wanted to make, and I thought because we're talking about this topic, it was really a great moment to just take a second and talk about it. And let's see, a couple things she wanted to say. She wanted to stress the bipartisan nature of passing HB 31 with help from Senator Anna McKinnon, and that they really worked hard to get, unique identifiers on the kits going forward. You know that idea if you order something, you can track your package across the U.S. Well, she was telling me that the sexual assault kits assembled in Anchorage that went out to the state actually didn't have a unique identifier before this bill. Now they do. And also they worked hard on high-capacity shelving in Anchorage so that kits are maintained and not lost. But also, very importantly, she stressed that they worked toward a victim-centered approach and that persons who experience a sexual assault would have sort of two tracks. They could request an anonymous report, which would mean the information, the DNA testing, the sexual assault kit information would be obtained in a timely fashion, but it would be set aside until the victim had time to decide whether she wanted to pursue this or not. Or they could also take a second approach, which was called a law enforcement approach, which would mean that they were going to pursue a case regarding their sexual assault. And also she was really pleased that they were able to obtain more training for law enforcement in sexual assault response. So she said it's so much bigger than the kits. And also she was proud that the legislature had actually worked in 2006 to do away with the statute of limitations that might prevent people from bringing cases due to them being old. So anyway, I just wanted to take a few minutes out and relay that conversation. And we may hear from Representative Tarr today, I'm not sure. But I thought she made some really good points. So now let's get back to our show. I'm going to ask Elaine to go ahead and introduce our two guests.
Thanks, Kathleen. We have some two highly qualified guests here today, and I'm as interested to learn from them as I hope you are. First, we have Ingrid Diane Johnson. She's an assistant professor at the Justice Center. Ingrid was raised in Delta Junction, so she is a in-state born and bred. Raised in Delta Junction and Fairbanks, and she received her BA in Justice from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Completed both her master's and a doctorate in criminal justice at Temple University in Philadelphia. The focus of much of Dr. Johnson's research is on help seeking among survivors of sexual assault and intimate partner violence and sexual assault, and how formal and informal networks can improve these processes. Dr. Johnson's research at Temple University included rural and urban differences in relation to criminal justice and access to substance abuse treatment for individuals involved in the criminal justice system. She is working in partnership with the Alaska Department of Public Safety as the principal research investigator for the Alaska Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, described sometimes as AKSACI, I'm assuming, or SACI. We also have here in the studio Dr. Brad Merstel. He is an associate professor at the Justice Center and director of the Alaska Justice Statistical Analysis Center. and Information Center. He received his doctorate in criminal justice from Indiana University in 2006, and his primary area of research is policing, with a specific focus on how the frequency and nature of interactions with law enforcement shape citizens' perceptions and understanding of the police and other criminal justice actors. In addition, he's conducted extensive research on the intersection of the criminal justice system and homelessness, and the criminal justice response to sexual assault and domestic violence. He recently received research funding from the U.S. Department of Justice to initiate the Alaska Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence Case Processing Project. So both of these experts have some significant overlap in their area of research. He also received funding from the U.S. Department of Justice to examine the impact of the VPSO, the Village Public Safety Officer Program, on the criminal justice response to violence committed against Alaska Native women in tribal communities. So we have folks here who can speak both on urban and rural justice issues, and we're honored to have them both.
Yeah. Before we start in with our questions and exploring the research that you guys can tell us about, I just want to let our listeners know, as usual, we welcome your questions or comments on Hometown Alaska, and you can reach us in Anchorage at 550-8433. Statewide, it is 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take an email at hometownalaskapublic.org. And I'll circle back and give these numbers out again. One more point, at alaskapublic.org, under Hometown Alaska, we have links related to this show. And in particular, you might hear us talk about a study later in the show called the Kaleidoscope Study. It's really interesting and really accessible. So we got permission from that was provided to us by the Justice Center, and we put it on our site so that people might read it. If this is this area of the process of sexual assault investigations is of interest to you, you might really appreciate some of the work that's gone into thinking about what does justice mean to the different stakeholders in sexual assault investigations. So remember that. It's alaskapublic.org, and just go to Hometown Alaska, and you'll see sort of the promo for our show today. And then scroll down a little bit, and you'll see some links, and that's where you'll find some useful information, including a link to the Justice Center itself. And that sort of brings me to my first question for Brad, actually, as a director there. You know, everybody has their own version of facts these days. There's a very polarized population. It seems to me incredibly important that we have independent research going on. So I just thought we would turn to you first to just talk a little bit about what the mission of the UAA Justice Center is.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity. It's great to be here today. For those listeners who may not be familiar with the Justice Center, we're a bit unique at UAA. We are a comprehensive teaching unit as well as a comprehensive research unit. So some many units at UAA just teach, or they just do research, and the Justice Center really is charged with doing both. And so we have comprehensive academic programs on the academic side of the house. We offer bachelor's degrees in legal studies and justice. And so legal studies students learn how to read and write and do legal analysis and writing. And our justice program is sort of a traditional criminal justice criminology program. So that's sort of one side of the house. And then on the other side of the house is the Alaska Justice Information Center, which is our organized research unit that's housed within the Justice Center. And it's comprised of five full-time some faculty and professional research staff who do nothing but research. And then sort of bridging those two things are the research agendas of the faculty of the UAA Justice Center. So we have an organized research unit in the Alaska Justice Information Center, and then each faculty member pursues their own line of inquiry that's, you know, commensurate with their training and interests and expertise. So when we talk about Justice Center research, there's faculty research, which we're going to be talking about later today in terms of Dr. Johnson's research, and then the organized research work that we do in the Alaska Justice Information Center.
So is it right to say that research questions can come from the faculty, or they can come from outside the university, from the legislature?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I might go so far as to say the best research questions come from outside the university, and that's really a major part of our focus in the Justice Center, is beginning with the questions that other people have, rather than beginning with academic questions that we have. And so we're deeply committed at the Justice Center to doing research for the real world, research that matters and is translatable into policy and practice that impacts real people's lives. Mm-hmm. So we're really passionate about that. And that's not to say that our faculty don't have their own research questions, but typically what we find is when we begin with agency questions or legislative questions, almost always the questions that we have, sort of those esoteric academic questions, get answered along the way. But we really do our utmost to begin with the questions that practitioners and policymakers have first, because that's sort of that translation piece that impacts everyday Alaskans.
Mm-hmm. And one other question I have is whether there is, you and I met last Friday and we talked a little bit about the importance of having data to look at over time. So I wondered, are there some studies, I'm sure, because I've seen them in headlines, victimization studies. What are you doing on an annual basis that maybe is building up the knowledge of Alaskans related to justice and crime? Are you doing some annual studies?
Well, we don't necessarily do annual studies. If I had to identify one area of research that folks may know us best for, it would be the research the Justice Center has done for a good long while now on intimate partner violence and sexual violence. So the Alaska Victimization Survey, in partnership with the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, is housed in the Justice Center. I've done work as well as several of my colleagues on criminal case processing. So given a report of a sex crime, what are the factors that help us understand whether or not that case is referred for prosecution? Given referral for prosecution, the factors that influence the likelihood of acceptance for prosecution. Given acceptance for prosecution, what factors help us understand conviction, sentence length, those sort of things as well. The Justice Center is also working with the University of Alaska Title IX office to help understand the extent to which intimate partner violence and sexual violence experiences among our students are impacting their academic lives as well as their lives more generally. And so to the extent that there's one area that the Justice Center may be known for, it would probably be that. But I am proud to say that we have tremendous faculty in the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center pursuing a number of, I think, very impactful and important crime and justice topics. Some things that immediately come to mind are projects on prisoner reentry and recidivism reduction, our partnership with the Alaska Judicial Council in assisting with the evaluation of criminal justice reform in the state of Alaska, the Alaska Justice Information Center's work with Results First, the Alaska Results First Initiative, which really sets out to sort of monetize and give the state an idea of return on investment in public policy programs. So it's wide-ranging, and I think it's all impactful. But if there's one area that folks might know the Justice Center for, it would be with intimate partner violence and sexual violence and the research we're doing mm-hmm. in that area.
excuse me. I was thinking how timely the Justice Center is at this time when the community questions and discussions and engagement over the rise in crime in Anchorage and perhaps other parts of the state is at an all-time peak. So I wonder, do you get calls from the public in addition to from legislators? And I'm kind of interested, what do they think you can tell them?
Well, I think oftentimes people call us because they want to understand why. Unfortunately, oftentimes we're not able to provide definitive answers as to why crime rates are up or crime rates are down or why a certain type of crime happened in a certain area but not another. It's, you know, crime is a human behavioral phenomenon. It's very complex, and it's not reducible to any one thing that caused it. But I would say, you know, people want to understand why things are happening. And so sometimes, you know, I think in the outreach that I do, people may be a little frustrated because we're unable to provide that singular, definitive answer of if we could only fix this one thing, everything else would be made better. But what I really try to encourage people to think about is that to think of crime holistically and in its interconnections to other things, for example, behavioral health, adverse childhood experiences, economic influences, so on and so forth.
Poverty. That,
yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely right. And mm-hmm. so as criminologists, you know, I think we try to do the very best we can to give people the information they need to make more informed decisions about what to do, but not ever with the idea that we're providing them the perfect information for a perfect solution.
Mm-hmm. We want immediate gratification. You know, once the concern is there, people are like, let's fix it, you know, and yet it takes time. And that's what you're trying. Is there any work that you wish you could do, that wish you had been funded over periods of time, that you had at your hands now to answer
yes.
these questions? And what might that look like?
Yes. So thank you for asking it. You might well imagine that a question that we're often getting is the relationship between illicit drug use and abuse and what we're seeing in both property and violent crime rates in the state of Alaska. And what I've had to tell people is, well, we have some drug data and we have quite a bit of crime data, but we don't have data that links drug use to crime. In the past, we did. And when I first came to Alaska back in 2002 as a graduate student, I was actually the project coordinator for the Arrestee Drug Abuse Monitoring Program. And so at that time, there were 29 sites across the U.S. This was a big project funded by the National Institute of Justice, which is in the U.S. Department of Justice. And what we did is we went in to the Anchorage Correctional Complex, and we went in there 4 times a year for 2 weeks at a time, twice a day. We spent between 8 and 10 hours a day in the jail, and we had a representative sample of people who were booked in for anything and everything. And we interviewed them, a very complex, detailed interview that was focused on substance abuse. And we were able to get self-report data on lifetime, past year, past 30 days, past 7 days, past 3 days, and the immediate 24 hours preceding their arrest. We also collected extensive data on drug market information, how they acquired drugs, did they trade, barter, pay cash, that sort of thing, how they came to acquire it. And at the end, actually, we asked for a voluntary urine sample, and almost everybody gave us one, believe it or not. Hmm. That sort of study is the sort of thing I wish we had now, because what we had is detailed biometric data as well as self-report data on drug use history. And then, of course, we had the information about people, the things they were accused of doing, right, that brought them to jail. And in that sort of study, we had information that directly linked, right, a person's substance abuse history to what they were in jail for that day, at least. And that's the kind of information that we really need to be able to unpack and begin understanding those relationships. Moreover, that study had been going on, not necessarily in Anchorage, but nationally since 1987. And so it was a study that was initially designed to serve as canary in the coal mine. So we know that that population, folks who are booked into jail, are at the forefront of illicit drug use, right? So before things hit the general population, they hit the jail population. And so if you're tracking the prevalence with which people are coming into jails, and we track the night of five drugs, it can be an early indicator of what you might see in a community sometime down the road.
Uh-huh.
And so you're developing a longitudinal data set about drug use patterns over time. That would also be tremendously beneficial. So that's just one example of the sort of effort that I think, you know, oftentimes can be difficult for people to think about and fund in advance of the problem. The challenge we have in research in general, in the Alaska, here in the Justice Center specifically, is, and I'll try to not sound overly bitter about this, but sometimes research folks don't want to fund research, but they want the answers in that moment, right? But it takes some foresight to invest in research infrastructure to be able to provide you the information you need for good data-informed policy decisions sometime down the road. But when the questions only come in that moment, but that research infrastructure hasn't been put in place,
it's hard for you to be definitive
about. That's right.
That study you're referring to, what launched it and how long did it go? Do you know?
Well, it went began in 1987 as the Drug Use Forecasting Program, and that was an initiative, again, out of the U.S. Department of Justice. So there were grant funds that were provided to sites to engage in this work. It went through, I hope I'm getting these dates right, 2003, and there was a change in administration at that time, and ADEM was shut down. And then it was reinvigorated a year or two later, I think it was in 2005, as ADEM 2 is restricted to 10 sites, major metropolitan areas. And then it was brought under ONDCP, the Office of National Drug Control Policy. So it was moved from the U.S. Department of Justice's research arm into that policy arm of the executive branch at the federal level. And it lasted a couple more years there. But at the current time, it's my understanding that essentially that research program effort is gone. Mm-hmm. So it lasted for a good long time.
It's interesting that it boils down to a question here in Anchorage, Alaska, that everybody went, why is our crime rate so high? What spiked it? Why?
So can I just step in and ask the question, since we have this statistician here? We all assume that the crime rate is high. Is that true? I mean, do you actually have numbers, and can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, sure. So both property crime and violent crime in Alaska are up. And the data we rely on for that are crimes reported to police. And it's what's called the Uniform Crime Reporting Program. And so that's not the universe of all crime that occurs, but what's actually reported to police. But we have those data going back. The data in most of my presentation goes back to the mid-80s. And so I'm able to get a good time series. And violent crime in particular, we're kind of in unprecedented territory in the state of Alaska. In the aggregate, violent crimes are higher than we have over the last generation. So we're talking 30 years or so. What's really interesting about that is that that challenge has been brewing for some time. I did not bring that presentation with me today, but really beginning in the early 2000s, Alaska started diverging from the rest of the United States. And in general, the rest of the U.S. is continuing an ongoing crime decline. Alaska is not only not enjoying a crime decline, but it's been getting worse for nearly 20 years. So from a policy perspective, this has been cooking for quite some time. In the past 3 or 4 years, though, violent crime, the trajectory has really taken a different direction upward, so a steeper increase. Property crime, on the other hand, we enjoyed a really good run in declining property crime rates in the state of Alaska until about 4 years ago. And then they started coming back up at a pretty good rate in some particular categories of property crime, most notably probably for your listeners is motor vehicle theft. So they're both in recent history, they're both on the uptick. But I think a more compelling story is the violent crime story, which has been building for quite some time.
Okay, we have to take a tiny break here. So that was really interesting, and I'm really glad we got there. You're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, here with my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. ¶¶
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm here with co-host Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Our topic today is new research at the UA Justice Center related to sexual assault. And we were, just before we took this break, we were talking a little bit about the rise of violent crime in Alaska kind of being on the uptick for almost 20 years, which is kind of a shock to hear. We're going to delve a little bit into that and fine-tune how sexual violence fits into that. I just want to put our numbers out there for listeners if they want to engage with us in this conversation or ask our experts questions. 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or of course we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And once again, our guests are Ingrid Johnson, a professor at UA Justice Center, doing new work that we're going to hear about in this segment, and Brad Mersterall, the director of the UA Justice Center. Let's start with just a little bit of background on Ingrid's research, and I don't know whether we need to clarify, violent crime and sexual assault, and are they one, does one fit under the other? But let's get to the research. Yes.
Yeah, so I think I'll let Ingrid talk specifically about her particular project, but I think it's a great example of what we're trying to achieve at the UAA Justice Center by having true and meaningful and lasting researcher-practitioner partnerships and really beginning with the question of what do practitioners want or need to know to do things better. So we have a long history of the Department of Public Safety and the Alaska State Troopers in doing case processing work and other studies, right? So DPS and AST, we've worked with them for a really long time. And because of that, we have a really good relationship. We know each other, and they trust us to be, to give it to them straight, right? We do high quality, sophisticated research, and we're able to help them translate that into meaningful policy and practice. And I think that the Saki project really is an extension, an ongoing extension of the work and the foundation that's been laid for a long time.
And the Saki work is the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, federal,
yes,
but also state, right?
Yeah, it's a state initiative, and it's a federal grant the Department of Public Safety received to help them deal with unsubmitted sexual assault kits.
But then how did we get research out of that? I mean, that was like, let's get them counted, let's get them, in the system, but how do we get to research? Ingrid, or Professor Johnson, actually.
So part of the grant that the Department of Public Safety got from BJA, so the Bureau of Justice Assistance at the federal level, had written into it for a research component. So they wrote in, we're also going to work with the UAA Justice Center to understand what's happening with our investigation, prosecution, victim engagement, and support in these sexual assault cases that are reported to the Alaska State Troopers. So I happen to be the lucky researcher who is that partner at the UAA Justice Center. So what they have tasked me with doing is designing a research project to help make recommendations to help them improve these processes. And the BJA grant was very specific in that it had to be a victim-centered approach to improving these processes. So again, investigation, prosecution, and victim engagement and support. So when I heard victim-centered, I knew that this project had to first and foremost involve the voices of people who had experienced sexual assault and reported those to the troopers. So that's been a priority for the project.
And just as if people weren't here when Elaine introduced you, you are from Alaska. You grew up here, went to school, I think, at UAF.
Mm-hmm.
Went outside to, is it Temple University, studied. And did your PhD was on intimate violence?
Yes, intimate partner violence. So my dissertation research was done in Philadelphia, so very different environment than here in Alaska, but potentially a study that could be done here, and it'd be interesting to see the difference. But what I was looking at is young women's experiences with intimate partner violence, whether they had talked to their friends and family about the violence they experienced, and then what kinds of reactions they got from those friends and family when they talked to them. And then I was looking at how those reactions, how that disclosure process shaped their experiences with violence. So this ties into this bigger understanding of how we create justice for survivors of violence, of intimate violence. So what we know with intimate partner violence and with sexual violence is that the incidents that are reported to law enforcement are just a fraction of the incidents that are occurring. So a very large number, especially with intimate partner violence, of these incidents just go unreported. So it's sort of what we would call in the field of criminology the dark figure of crime. I often use an iceberg analogy to talk about this, where the tip of the iceberg is what we're seeing in the more formal systems, and then underneath the surface of the water is really the scope of the problem. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really interested in my sort of broader research agenda of how we create justice for the entire iceberg, for the entire dark figure and light figure, you know, what mm-hmm. we can see formally and what we can't see, and really understanding what justice means to people, because if people aren't seeking justice from the criminal justice system, how can we create justice for them? Can we create justice for them? And then how can the formal system and the informal systems work together to create justice?
And I have just one tiny question. Did growing up in Alaska set you on this course, because we have had an issue with sexual assault for a long time?
Yeah, so my focus has much more been in the realm of intimate partner violence, but also sexual violence. And so when I went to Philadelphia to start my graduate studies, I was much more on a track of studying substance abuse and substance abuse treatment and how that can be better integrated into the criminal justice system. But what I found as I went through my graduate studies was that all of the papers I was writing were centering on intimate partner violence and sexual violence. And there comes a point when you end your coursework in graduate school and you sort of have to decide what your research agenda is really going to be at that point. And I realized what was really driving me was questions about intimate partner violence and justice for victims of intimate partner violence and sexual violence. It did stem directly from being from the state of Alaska, where we have such high rates. I was writing papers about what it was like to seek help in rural areas if you were a survivor of intimate partner violence. I was looking at Alaska's how they deal with batter intervention programs. So I was looking at the batter intervention program in Fairbanks and thinking about, how to help them make some organizational changes to improve their programming. It was really just tied to what I have seen and know about more personally and mm-hmm. wanting to.
And one last question. Were you bent on coming back to Alaska, or were we just lucky that we had the right research that you were interested in and that's how you landed back?
I was pretty bent. I think when I first started graduate school, I thought, oh, I could live anywhere. And I think after maybe a semester, I was like, no. I need to live in Alaska. So,
Okay.
We all got lucky, I think.
yeah. Go ahead,
I have a question for you. You refer to sexual violence and intimate partner violence as two separate things. And there's obviously a research reason that you do that and mm-hmm. a definitional reason. How do you differentiate between those two? What things are you talking about?
Well, so there's a huge overlap, but they are two different things. So with intimate partner violence, I'm talking about things that don't necessarily include sexual violence. So it can be physical violence, psychological violence, stalking, and sexual violence committed by a current or former intimate partner. And intimate partners can be spouses, boyfriends or girlfriends, sexual partners, dating partners, et cetera, et cetera. So with intimate partner violence, it's looking at that intimate partner thing and not just sexual violence. And then with sexual violence, that's rape being the most extreme form, but also unwanted sexual contact of a variety of natures. And that can come from intimate partners, but it can also come from strangers, acquaintances, friends, mm-hmm. et cetera. So there's a huge overlap, but two different acts.
Okay. So do you have enough follow-up question, Elaine? So let's talk about your research, because the compelling question for me is, what does justice look like? And you've already sort of from your past research learned that many times people don't seek justice in the traditional criminal justice system, but you're engaged with the criminal justice system. And so tell us really what is your question and who all are we talking? We're talking to victim survivors, but are we also talking to police officers and prosecutors and even judges? I don't know. So tell us about that.
Yes. So I actually have three research questions. And again, this so it has to be a victim-centered project, not only because that's what I want, but also because that's what the Department of Public Safety wants and the Bureau of Justice Assistance. So the first question is basically, what do stakeholders involved in the sexual assault investigation, prosecution, victim engagement, and support process see as being just outcomes? Because all of this, this whole project is to improve access to just outcomes, but we have to start with an understanding of what just outcomes are. So key stakeholders is sort of this catch-all term that we use in different ways in academia. And so the key stakeholders in this process not only include the survivors who reported to the troopers, reported to sexual assault, but also the troopers themselves. It includes people who work in the emergency rooms and might be interacting with these survivors when they initially report. It includes sexual assault nurse examiners, or SANEs, sexual assault response team coordinators, who are the people who are in charge of making this the sexual assault response team process happen, which the state of Alaska has been doing for quite some time. It includes prosecutors and other people working with the DA's office, superior court judges. It'll include people working at the Department of Public Safety's crime lab testing the sexual assault kits.
Would it include advocates?
Oh, yes, victim advocates. I was like, who am I missing here?
Oh, okay.
Most definitely victim victim service advocates. So a whole range of people who are involved from the very beginning of the reporting process through to the end. These are all stakeholders who are all involved at some point in time in interacting with the victim survivors or just with their cases. And so looking at what the process looks like from their perspective and then what just outcomes look like from their perspective.
So would you anticipate a lot of different answers to that question depending on the stakeholders?
And I don't even know about depending on the stakeholders, but I anticipate a lot of different answers. And so part of this first research question is to not only understand the variety of perceptions and experiences, but also where those perceptions overlap and sort of a series of Venn diagrams kind of, or a series of circles overlapping, and where they diverge. And then it'll be a really interesting question at some point to discuss whose perceptions of just outcomes do we prioritize as a criminal justice system. But
would it be safe to say, because there's so much emphasis on victim-centered justice right now, I know Elaine and I had a victims' rights program on here before, but is it fair to say that victims have been left out of the process, or in some cases, or how do we put them in context with why we need to look hard at victim-centered justice now?
Yes. So historically, our criminal justice system has been built on this concept that crimes are crimes committed against the state. So that's the criminal justice system that we've been operating in under in the United States for a very long time. And so in a way, victims have just sort of been removed from the picture. So seeking justice through our criminal justice system has been all about ensuring due process for those who have committed a crime, which is a fantastic component of our criminal justice system, ensuring due process and making sure that people who have offended are held accountable. And usually in the case of our criminal justice system, that means they're either put under community supervision like probation or they're incarcerated. And so really, victims haven't played a key role in that except as, to give evidence to point out who committed the crime or not, but they haven't had a voice, and they haven't had a voice in what happens and what really is justice for them. For the last several decades, we've seen the victims' rights movement, which has tried to bring victims into the criminal justice system and to give them more of that voice. So we've seen things like victim impact statements a more coordination between the district attorney's office and victim advocates working with the district attorney to help victims navigate the system, because often the system really leaves them out communicating about what's going on with their cases. So there's been efforts to improve our current criminal justice system and how we engage and support victims. But it's complicated because it's very hard to have this system that's built, again, to guarantee due process and to be very focused on the offender. And in some ways, it's almost like we're trying to shoehorn victims and their rights into that system. And there's some tension there, and it's been a bit of a difficult process.
Mm-hmm. Well, we need to take another break, so we will do that right now. We'll be back in about a minute, and you are listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, here with co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, and we are talking today about new research at the UA Justice Center that has been funded by a federal grant to take a look at the process in sexual assault investigations from the point of view of all stakeholders to look at outcomes, just outcomes. And so we've been talking with Ingrid Johnson here, who's a professor at the UA Justice Center, who's embarking on this research project. She's here with Brad Mistral, the director of the UA Justice Center, who gave us kind of an overview of some of the mission of that center. But we're going to go back to Professor Johnson's study. We started out with looking at question number one. There were three questions in your research. So let's go ahead and finish with just two and three, and then delve a little bit more deeply into what justice outcomes might look like for victim survivors.
Right. Okay, so for the first research question, it's what are those just outcomes? And to answer that research question, I do interviews with these key stakeholders, learn a lot from that. And then using what I learned from those interviews, using what the different options, I guess you could call them, of what these stakeholders identify as being just outcomes, I then move into my second and third research question. So the second research question is really how prevalent are these just outcomes? And so there's two different data sources that I'll be using to answer that research question, because from the interviews, the interviews from the first research question are not meant to be representative. They're not meant to tell us how prevalent, how many survivors believe that these are just outcomes or see these just outcomes that are identified. That's what we get into with the second research question. So with that, I'll be using Department of Public Safety electronic records as well as Department of Law electronic records. And so that'll allow me to look at things like, excuse me, arrests and convictions. But what we're expecting to find, or what I'm expecting to find from the first research question, is these more, I don't know about intangible, but these kinds of just outcomes that are not going to exist in electronic databases. So they could be things like frequent communication from various criminal justice actors with the victim. And so that's not something I'm going to be able to find in the records. So I'm planning on doing a series of surveys a set of surveys with a bigger number of survivors who reported to the Alaska State Troopers, asking them how often they experienced these different aspects that have been identified as just outcomes from the first research question. And then finally, for the third research question, this is getting into sort of the why or the how is basically what factors are associated with those just outcomes. So we will know what the just outcomes are, how prevalent they are, and how not only how prevalent these different expectations of justice are, but also how often they occur. And then we'll start looking at what factors shape the likelihood of experiencing those just outcomes so that we can hopefully, that's where the recommendations would come in to create more opportunities for those just outcomes to occur.
Okay. I neglected to just share our phone numbers with our listeners, 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or you can also send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I would like to bring up this study that you shared with me called the Kaleidoscope Justice Study, which was really interesting to me. It comes from the UK, and I think in terms of you sharing it with me, you said it's like one of the first that might be looking at what victim survivors have to say about justice. Can you tell us a little? It is on our website if people are. It's not a number filled study. It's really very accessible and interesting, filled with the voices of victims, actually. So
yes, yeah, so yeah, it is a very accessible study. It's a qualitative study, just like for the first component of mine will be, where I'm just doing. They're doing interviews. In this case, they did focus groups in the UK. And I believe they talked to 20-something survivors. And so what they found, and just like, I would say, just like the criminal justice system has sort of neglected victim survivors, research has as well neglected the voices of victim survivors. And so this is one of the first studies, and it's quite new, that has actually asked, well, what is justice to you? And so what they found is that it includes aspects of our traditional system. So it includes things like offenders being held accountable, but it includes a lot more of these more, like I was getting at, intangible things as well. So one of the things that the participants in the focus group talked about was being treated with dignity. So being treated as a human being, not only by the criminal justice system, but by their family and friends and other people that they told. Recognition of harm by the offender came up quite a bit. So it gets in line with this idea of accountability, but it wasn't even that they were hoping for punishment or incarceration. It's just that they wanted the acknowledgement by the offender that they had done something to harm the survivor and the victim. And that was something that came up over and over again. What was really interesting from that study is this concept of prevention and justice being bigger than an individual's outcome. And so a lot of them talked about justice for them just being the prevention of these sexual assaults happening in the future. And so for them, justice wasn't unique to them. It was preventing sexual violence from happening to anyone else. And so how that prevention comes about is kind of a bigger question of whether that's a deterrence through the criminal justice system, whether that's rehabilitation. But really, they just want to see less sexual violence in society overall. And for that, for them, that would be a form of justice.
That's fascinating. Let's see. I'm trying to think of some of the other points in the Kaleidoscope study. Things like, and I wonder, Judge Andrews, whether this exists for victims and perpetrators to be face to face. Is that part of the Kaleidoscope? I mean, there was some desire to tell a perpetrator what you have done to me.
I think, yeah, well, that can get into like the voice of the survivor and being actively engaged in the process. I think that's a highly individualized preference of whether survivor victims want to come face to face with the person who has committed violence against them. There's a variety of restorative justice processes in general, not just for sexual violence, that they'll have programs where victims can talk to offenders who were not their offenders, but were, you know, they can tell people who committed similar crimes about the harm done to them so that they don't have to go face to face with the person who committed a crime against them. Because of the violent nature of these crimes, that can be far too overwhelming for some victim survivors. But being able to talk about what happened to them to another offender in a sort of similar capacity can be very healing. But again, that's it's a highly individualized preference of what
sure,
victim survivors want.
Sure, and I can totally understand that. You know, I think the term kaleidoscope justice is kind of interesting because that's like a toy where you can spin the end of it and you get constantly changing images. And the point being that justice doesn't end at some point, that it's evolving, that And I don't know, can you speak to that a little bit? Because I thought it's very visual, but what does it mean?
Right. So the authors of the article talk about it being not only constantly changing, but also unpredictable, depending on the person, and this idea that it does change over time. You know, some people reach out to the criminal justice system right away, and they may or may not get what they want from the criminal justice system at that time. And then over time, their concept of what they need to heal and what they need to move on might shift and change. And everybody has a highly individualized path towards recovery and justice.
So that's why they use this term kaleidoscope. Another key word in that study was connectedness, and I think victims feeling connected to their community again. And is that about being ostracized because you've been a victim of sexual assault, or being seen as being labeled as that and not being part of the community? What's that connectedness about?
If I recall correctly, and how I interpreted that is, they were talking about this concept of feeling whole and recovery as a person, and just how connectedness to their community could help them to feel that wholeness again.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some people, they could feel ostracized. And for other people, it could just be that, you know, it's an individual thing, but they need community support to become
right.
whole again.
And also coming together with other victims. That was, I remember something else there, finding voice because you're not alone. There was some power in that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And these are all aspects of what justice might look like for somebody. I think we should talk a little bit about how you're going to go about your study. We have this vast state. We have rural communities. We have urban communities. Tell us how you're seeking 20 to 40?
40, approximately.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I'm looking for 40 survivors of sexual assault who were adults when they were assaulted and reported that sexual assault to the troopers, the Alaska State Troopers, between 2006 and 2016. So to recruit these survivors, I will be posting flyers. Well, I'll be seeking a lot of help from communities across the state because, again, a lot of rural communities far away from Anchorage. So seeking help in posting these flyers in various locations, asking people to reach out to me. So I'm relying on people to see these materials and say, yes, I want to share my experience. So it's a 1 to 2 hour interview. I'm compensating my participants with a $45 gift card. And I'm hoping to do the interviews in person. So this will require me to fly and drive all over the state. As far as Alaska's most rural communities, this will be an especially interesting challenge. I'm working hard right now to set up relationships with various organizations in these communities that can disseminate the recruitment materials, but also sort of assist with helping me find rooms to do the interviews in when I go to these communities. Yes,
there's privacy issues. So you said you were staying in hub communities primarily so that people would feel that they had their privacy was protected.
Right. So one of the key concerns with doing these interviews is that people's identity is confidential. So I'm going to know who they are. If they don't want anyone else to know, I don't want anyone else to know that they even participated in the research. So for confidentiality purposes, it wouldn't really work for me to go into small villages because everybody knows you're there. So even in hub communities, things could get a little tricky. But I am going to work with whoever wants to participate in the study as far as whatever seems most comfortable to them, as far as where they want to meet and when they want to meet. I'm also going to have doing the interview via phone as an option if people really feel like they can't meet with me in a place that is safe and confidential for them. I advocate for doing it in person just because of the sensitive nature of the interviews. But really, I want anyone who wants to share their experience to feel like they can and they can do so safely.
And your questions will elicit their reaction to the experience of going through the sexual assault investigation process.
Yes. So they're semi-structured interviews. So I have questions asking about not only their experience with the assault, which they can share as much or as little information on as they want to, And then basically what the reporting process looked like from their perspective, who they talked to, who they interacted with, what it was like for them. And after I get all of that information, then I move into the questions about justice. And so what does justice mean to them in the case of a sexual assault? Do they feel like justice was done in their case? Why or why not? What kind of things could have been done differently?
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have another set of interviews aimed at troopers and prosecutors, different questions?
Yeah, different process. The questions are very similar. They're meant to mirror each other. So, and it's a different process for recruitment. So for those interviews, I'm getting lists of individuals who work for those agencies during the 2006 to 2016 timeframe. And they'll be notified by various representatives that they know. That I will be reaching out, and I'm going to randomly select a handful and just start reaching out to people at those agencies to participate in those interviews. And then the questions, it's a same semi-structured interview, but the questions are, when someone reports a sexual assault, what role do the troopers play? What role does the sexual assault nurse examiner play? What is the sexual assault exam kit collection like, et cetera, et cetera? So they mirror the questions for the survivors, but they're more in the third person. So what does it look like for a survivor of sexual assault? Mm-hmm. And then same with the survivors I get into. In these cases, what does justice mean to you? Do you think that justice is done in these cases? Mm-hmm. And what recommendations for improvements do they mm-hmm. have?
Mm-hmm. So I think that this is interesting. It's fascinating. I think it's, I'm looking forward to the results of the research. And, all of this takes money. It sounds to me like this is a federally funded effort. This mm-hmm. is not state funded. But mm-hmm. the state funds, at least some came in getting some of these rape kits tested. But that's actually, relatively speaking, a small piece of this. But it's a huge piece in the sense that people have, a rape kit doesn't occur unless someone reports. Mm-hmm. And that means they are, by definition, in contact with a police officer and then a nurse. And the shocking thing is how many of these victims went through this whole intrusive process and the kits did not get tested. So what are you involved in any of that except to say that would not be justice? I mean, if you participated and found out that your kit was sitting on a shelf, but it looks like there's a movement to get those tested now.
Yes. So the movement is happening nationally through these Bureau of Justice Assistance grants and also at state levels to get the kits tested. I think, this is all stemmed from, stemmed out of Detroit, I want to say, in about 2012 when they discovered thousands and thousands of unsubmitted kits and there was a huge public outcry. So yes, it's definitely a justice issue.
We could talk about this for another hour. really a fascinating, and I have a feeling that our listeners were really hanging on. This is really new territory, a new approach, very interesting. So I'd really like to thank everyone, co-host Judge Elaine Andrews, our guests, Professor Ingrid Johnson and Professor Brad Murstall, and of course our listeners. I'll be back as your host next Monday when Hometown Alaska, in true community spirit, hosts its annual Thank You to Volunteers. This is an opportunity for all those groups in Anchorage and Alaska who rely on volunteers to help get important community work done. Next week, you can call us up and thank them on the air. And this year, we will add a different component, the value of philanthropy in shaping community. We'll hear from guests Joe Mahalski, Lisa Aquino from Catholic Social Services, and Nina Kemple of the Alaska Community Foundation. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining.
For its content, views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.